Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we have seen the cracks emerge in Babylon, we have seen the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen, and Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is October 17, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is with us again for the seventh part of the installment dealing with Jewish revolutions and anarchy in Europe. How are you tonight, sir?
Hello. Praise Yahweh.
Absolutely. Praise Yahweh. And would you like to do a brief recap of where we were in the last few weeks?
Well, you know, if anybody's ever read, I don't have anything prepared, I'm sorry, but if anybody's ever read A. Ralph Epperson's An Unseen Hand, and if anybody hasn't, they should, that they would see Epperson, how he explained, and he did it quite well, how the Jewish opposition to European civilization for, ever since the French Revolution, right, used pressure at the top and pressure at the bottom to weaken the fabric and backbone of the European nobility and society as we knew it, and they used that to break the feudal system. They developed the capitalist system, and then they used the capitalist system at the top and the labor unions and the labor movements at the bottom to basically destroy the noble classes and the middle class.
Through communism.
Well, right, for the sake of communism, because that's what they really want to institute. They seek to create anarchy so that they can institute communism in every nation. Hmm. And communism is, as we've seen so many times here, the political expression of the Talmudism. Right, exactly. We've seen the French Revolution, and the Masonic lodges were behind it, and the Jewish, I can only call them anarchists or revolutionists, were behind that. And we've seen every revolution that followed that, 1848, 1871, it was the same godless forces. And the biggest organizations behind all of these revolutions were the Masonic lodges and the Jesuits.
And interestingly enough, all these revolutionaries, despite what era and what nation they happen to be in, it could be 13th century France with those people who wanted the church and marriage abolished and property abolished, or it could be 1848 Germany, they all have the same demands, and none of the demands are ever unique to their nation or their particular local circumstances, because it's not a local revolution.
Well, right. The demands are always the they want to change the state, they want to abolish religion, they want to destroy the family structure. And that's what they've sought to do from the time the serpent first whispered in Eve's ear. That's what they've sought to do. It's the same old battle, and that is the cause behind all of the revolutions of Europe throughout the 19th century. And when they could not defeat the nobility, even after the 1872 revolution, the Internationale faded into oblivion, more or less, because that was co-opted by the same revolutionists that they had taken that over. And that probably started out as a legitimate labor movement, but the revolutionists, as Nestor Webster explained, took over the Internationale. We saw that fade into oblivion, and now it's syndicalism. And syndicalism, it is what we're trying to explain now from Nestor Webster, from World Revolution. Syndicalism is basically, it's a further development of the creed of anarchy, that it rests on the same basis, the negation of the state, and once the old states of Europe that were operated by the nobility were marginalized, the Jews would have they'd be able to install their communist governments That's what they've always sought to do.
With the marginalizing of the international, they basically set the stage for World War I to bring about what they wanted. Since they couldn't achieve it through anarchistic revolutions, they needed a global conflagration.
Right. The international fell, and then syndicalism failed. And with the failure of all of these Jewish revolutions in Europe for 100 years, I believe that World War I was their last attempt to... It was just the latest attempt in a long series of revolutions to destroy Europe. When they couldn't do it through social upheaval, they did it through all-out war. That they engineered the war to affect their means. If the International had been successful, if syndicalism had been successful, if the 1848 revolutions had been successful, there would have been no World War I. Just like here in the 1950s and 60s, there was a social revolution that was successful.
If there was
not
World War
successful, III. Well, right. If it was not successful, there would have been a World War III. Exactly. We would have had overt war with Russia. Now, because those social revolutions were successful, the wall in Berlin fell.
Certainly.
It didn't fall because the Soviets became capitalists. It fell because we became communists.
So all those people who were building their bomb shelters in the 50s and 60s but letting their daughters go to Columbia, they didn't need a bomb shelter because they let their daughter go to Columbia.
Well, exactly. Exactly, because their children were educated by the Bolsheviks and turned into Bolsheviks. Look at the nation now. Tell me we're not a Bolshevik nation.
We're a nation of the Frankfurt School.
Well, absolutely. And we're one step away from 1920s Russia at any given moment.
Because the Jews used the excesses of Jewish capitalism to push people into the arms of Jewish Bolshevists.
Well, that's basically where we are. And that's how Epperson explained that, is pressure from the top and pressure from the bottom. Agitation, really, at the bottom. To affect the Jewish world government, which is where they're headed, where they've been headed for since the French Revolution. Well, this might seem mundane. We left Nesta Webster, and she's explaining the different kinds of strikes, of workforce labor strikes that they had employed in the age of syndicalism in the 1800s, and I think that even though it's mundane, it's important to understand because it helps us understand how they use labor against society. If we understand this, we'll also understand a little better all of the labor movements of the 1960s and 70s in this country. Well, when I was a child, when I was a teenager, all you heard about was what the UAW was doing. Was what the Teamsters were doing. Right, they were in the news every night. And then all of a sudden they disappeared from the news. Why did they disappear from the news? They disappeared from the news because the Wall Street capitalists were able to get what they wanted out of them. That they were able to use them to help destroy the image of American industry in the eyes of the people. That this is my opinion, and what have we had ever since? We've had the rise of China and the people buying Chinese goods and Japanese goods and enriching the Asian nations.
Like Jimmy Hoffa disappeared and they're never going to find him. All the steel mills have disappeared and we're never getting them back.
Well, right, exactly. But everybody was paying more attention to Jimmy Hoffa than they were to the steel mills. So from the days of Ronald Reagan, we heard hardly anything about what labor unions in the media compared to the way it was in the 1970s. Well, when they permeated the media, all you ever did was hear about them. And it's all a part of the manipulation of the minds of the general public.
Organized labor was incredibly violent at the time, weren't they, in enforcing strikes?
Well, there was a great deal of violence up until the 1970s when it came to strikes and things like that. And they seemed to get away with murder many times. Maybe not literally, but figuratively, at least. Okay. Now, as Mermo has pointed out, there are three kinds of general strike. One, the cooperative general strike of the workers. Two, the parliamentary general strike of the socialists. And three, the revolutionary general strike of the syndicalist leaders. Let us deal with these one by one. The cooperative general strike was conceived by the workers, as conceived by the workers, was not originally a measure of violence. Strikes throughout the early history of the labor movement had been the workers' only method of obtaining redress from exploitation, and no one but a Robespierre or a Lenin would deny the workers' right to lay down his tools if the conditions of his labor appeared to him unjust. Now notice that Webster's pointing out, basically, without mentioning it, she's pointing out the hypocrisy of both Robespierre and Lenin.
Have you ever heard of a labor strike in revolutionary France or Bolshevik Russia?
Hell no, but those movements claim to represent the proletariat, right? To represent the working class.
The proletariat has the right to anything except striking.
The cooperative
work, they'll be in a gulag.
The cooperative general strike was simply a development of this time-honored method of expressing discontent, which, carried out on a larger scale, would enable workers in all industries to bring an effective support to the demands of their oppressed comrades. As Mermo points out, the working men's conception of the way in which the plan would work was very naive. Someday one would stay home, one would not go to the workshop. The bourgeois who fattens on the sweat of the people would waste away because the people would cease to sweat. It would be a strike of folded arms. One would not go down into the street in tumultuous crowds. One would not expose oneself to the brutalities of the police and the guns of the soldiery. One would walk out in a family party to lunch on a fortification in the woods of Vincennes, in the Bois de Boulogne, or even further, in the smiling suburbs where the exploiters had their country houses. Would not this method be much better than that of the socialist politicians, who first of all advised one to vote for them, their electoral success being the first stage on the way to final victory, and who, once elected, would think only of their reelection? So the American political system is nothing new, huh?
That would
the general
that once you get someone elected in parliament, all they do is they concern themselves with keeping their seat, and they don't care
absolutely
about the revolutionary character of the party.
Absolutely, and they forget everything that they got elected for.
Let's call that
the general strike would be the revolution carried out as a huge joke. One would divert oneself with the expressions of the employers growing day by day more disconsolate. One would watch them grow pale, yellow, distorted, and their rage would be powerless against the brave proletarians who would simply make use of their right to idleness, the right of man, a natural and sacred right, which the bourgeois has so long selfishly enjoyed alone. So man has the right to be idle. That sounds like the American workforce of today. When it had had enough of it, the class of leeches would ask to capitulate. The proletariat would dictate its conditions. Give me back what you have stolen from me. That is to say, give me back everything and we will become good friends again.
Whatever.
I will go back into your workshop to work, not as one exploited for your profit, but to work as a free social producer. And the bourgeois could not do otherwise than subscribe to this treaty.
Well, how could you give someone something that wasn't theirs?
Right. That in reality, the worker would grow pale. Yellow would, in fact, be dead before the employer reached the ends of his resources, did not enter into the reckonings of the brave proletarians, nor does it still today when the plan of the general strike is placed before them. Well, which is true. But most people are two paychecks away from being dispossessed of their homes. Most Americans are two paychecks away of being put out in the streets from their apartments. And most Americans are one or two paychecks away from starvation. The parliamentary general strike, as approved by certain socialists, aims at a quite different denouement. It is not to end in improved relations between workers and employers or in an entente between the workers and the government, but in the overthrow of the political party which holds the reins of power in favor of the socialists themselves. A general strike conducted on these lines would not dispossessed the Socialist Party of the command, which it has abrogated to itself over the working classes. On the contrary, it would confirm this command and leave it to the role it has chosen of businessman to the proletariat. Even Mr. Ramsay MacDonald, arch opponent of the revolutionary general strike, admits the expediency of the political variety. The general strike, he observes, can be declared for two purposes. It can be used to secure some specific demand, say an extension of the franchise, the resignation of the government, or the defeat of a war party. As a last resort, as a coup de grace, it may be justifiable and need not be unsuccessful. In order, therefore, to place Mr. Ramsay MacDonald and his friends at the helm of the state to overthrow a government that retains an insular prejudice against foreign invasion and to paralyze national defense, it may be necessary to bring upon the country the immense suffering caused by a general strike, which, when carried out by syndicalists, as Mr. MacDonald himself remarks, hits the poor people heaviest, the middle classes next, and the richest, and the rich least of all.
That's what they did in Germany in 1918.
Well, absolutely.
Anyway, they wrecked the war effort with a general strike.
Yes, they did. Which Hitler wrote about, right? The Jews in every corporation, in every company, in every industry had encouraged that general strike.
Who but the Jews would be able to call for and coordinate a general strike?
Well, they're the only ones with the nationwide solidarity to do things like that.
And the motive to do it.
White people just don't stick together. And they had every motive to do it because after the Balfour Declaration, they wanted Germany to lose the war.
Because the Germans were allied with the Ottoman Empire, and when the Ottomans lose the war, Palestine goes to Jewry.
For revolutionary socialists today, as in 1793, tours les moyens sont bons. I'm sorry, I don't know what that means. But the revolutionary general strike, the form of general strike advocated by the syndicalists and that now forms the program of extremist trade union leaders, aims neither at a reorganization of industry nor at a change of government in the political sense, but at the complete destruction of constitutional government by violence of the most frightful kind. It is here that we come back to the connection between anarchy and syndicalism, not only in the syndicalist system, a development of the creed of anarchy, but its method for inaugurating it comprises the exact program of the earlier anarchists. So they're basically using the labor movement in the late 19th century to effect the revolutions that had failed when they were outright revolutions, right? Now, it will be remembered that the idea of useful larceny had first been suggested by Weishaupt, a principle applauded by Brissot and put into practice by Marat when he urged the populace to pillage the shops. Babeuf, though a communist, had carried on the same tradition in his plan of, quote, the great day of the people, when the people were to rise as one man and lay violent hands upon property.
Well, that's bourgeois property. It's not property in general. Since if they were just to take property, the Jews would be the ones pillaged the most since they have the most property.
Well, of course. From Babeuf onwards, the scheme had been logically abandoned by communists, since communism aims at mob rule, not at mob rule, but at bureaucracy, but continued along the line of anarchy. Proudhon, in his revival of Brissot's axiom, property is theft, and that's we saw that in the French Revolution, right? We saw that 100 years before Brissot, right?
Absolutely. What was it they said, that everything belongs to everyone and no man can own anything?
Well, absolutely. That was the ideas behind the French Revolution. That was the ideas behind its proponents.
Well, that's what the Talmud teaches in regards to Goyim. Everything of the Goyim belonged to the Jews, and no Goy can own anything.
Yes, it is. So property is theft unless a Jew holds it, in reality, right? Bakunin, in his glorification of robbery, and finally Kropotkin, in his theory of the great expropriation, all followed out the same idea, namely that of a quote-unquote, great day of revolution when the maddened multitude, driven by want and desperation, should rise against all wealth and property in one overpowering onslaught. Had not Bakunin and Nechayev indicated this design in an illuminating sentence, quote, we must increase and heighten the evils and sorrows so as to wear out the patience of the people and drive them to insurrection en masse. By this means only the social revolution could be accomplished and civilization, obnoxious civilization, wiped out at one stroke.
That's why they're not willing to compromise or negotiate, and no matter what the bourgeois business owners offer, they never accept it because they don't want to improve the plight of the workers by addressing reasonable grievances. They want to heap up grievance upon grievance until it's overwhelming and the camel's back is broken. They want bloodshed in the streets, don't they?
Well, there's no doubt.
We've seen that time and time again.
That's the anarchy that they wanted, and they couldn't. They tried it three times in Europe, and it failed every time. And now they're trying it through that they've co-opted the labor unions, and they're trying to use the quote-unquote proletariat from the time of at least from the time of Marx to effect their revolution, and they still couldn't pull it off.
We saw in Russia. The Tsar gave them a constitution. There were only 5,000 police in all of Russia, and every time the Tsar gave them something, they repaid him by killing him, and then his son would come in, and they'd repay him by attempting to assassinate him. Several Tsars were killed, blown to pieces. One even pardoned his would-be assassins, and they repaid him by trying to kill him again. And then ultimately, the only thing the Tsar could do to please them was die.
Well, basically, the history of the Tsars is a lesson in what happens when you negotiate with Satan. I mean, what else would you expect?
You don't compromise. You don't give Satan a pardon. When you identify Satan, you kill it.
Well, absolutely. And the Tsars could not learn that lesson, could they?
You don't give Satan one-third of your country to settle in, what they did with the Pale Settlement. So the Jews already had a homeland. They just didn't like it. They wanted the world.
But how were the people to be driven to this pitch of exasperation? Obviously, by hunger, which is what they did in the Soviet Union, right? The want, and what everybody's afraid they're going to do here. The want of bread alone, as the Orleanists of 1789 had clearly perceived, can be depended on to produce popular insurrection. And in the 18th century, famine had been easy enough to engineer by buying up supplies, waylaying wagons of corn, or throwing sacks of flour into the river. But 100 years later, improved means of transport and the complicated modern system of food distribution had made such primitive methods impracticable. How, then, were want and hunger to be brought about? Only by some gigantic coup that would paralyze the whole country and lead to the great expropriation dreamt of by the anarchists. Syndicalism now provided the weapon by which this was to be accomplished, the general strike. Let us examine the program of the revolutionary general strike as resumed by Marmoux from the declaration of its advocates, and we shall see how exactly the grand soir of the syndicalists corresponds with the anarchist's idea of the great day of revolution. First of all, a series of isolated strikes is to take place in various industries by way of partially paralyzing capital and of unsettling labor. Then, at a given signal, the workers, roused to violence by want and idleness, are to invade the workshops, mines, factories, etc., and take possession of them. At this stage, of course, the government will be obliged to call in the aid of the police and soldiery, and the fight will begin. The revolutionaries will cut the telegraph lines and telephone wires. Railway lines will be torn up to prevent the transport of troops or provisions. At the same time, it is hoped that a number of the soldiers will go over to the side of the revolution. By this means, the capital will be starved out, the markets will be empty, and the inhabitants rendered savage by hunger may be expected to turn on the government and also on the bourgeois. Of course, there is always the possibility that the population, instead of turning on the government, will turn upon the revolutionaries. But this last prospect does not disconcert the partisans of revolution by the general strike. The partisans will fight amongst themselves. Well, then, things will go all the better. Everything that will make confusion worse would be an advantage.
They just want chaos.
Well, exactly. They want to create a desolation. And in the end, if the revolutionaries fail to overthrow the government, the havoc they will work will be irretrievable. Before evacuating all the workshops, the syndicalists will resort to sabotage. All the instruments of labor will be destroyed. The railways will remain unusable. The ruin of capital will be complete. What then? After that, frankly, the apostles of syndicalism promise nothing. Their conception ceases with this final climax. A series of atrocious scenes, of burnings, of ruins, of murders, of terror, carried out by tramps, poachers, marauders, with terror rising from below and ending in a fearful melee. Didn't the Jews always enlist the worst of the lowest classes of people to do their bidding? And what I really want to ask is, how did American academia simply ignore all of this European history in the 20th century? And that proves to me alone by itself that American academia is controlled by the same people who were trying to pull this off.
Absolutely, and it's been controlled for the last 100-plus years.
Well, absolutely. One must read for oneself the work of M. Georges Sorel to realize this idea, well characterized by Mermoz as the dream of a norastenic Negro king can seriously enter into the calculations of a man outside a lunatic asylum. Well, no, it doesn't, because now we have one. But to M. Sorel, the prospect offers nothing alarming. On the contrary, whilst admitting that the general strike will be a catastrophe of which the process baffles description, the leading apostle of syndicalism regards it as the goal towards which all agitation should tend. Syndicalists, he declares, concentrate all socialism in the drama of the general strike. And I believe that's a part of the entire labor movement here of the 70s, was also used to break down the fabric of our society so that we would be more inclined towards socialism. It is, in fact,
now that they've done their job, we don't hear about them anymore because they're not needed.
Well, right. The plight of the workers, the UAW, the Teamsters, all these people, how hard they work, how little they get paid, blah 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 blah, on and on and on. The social injustice, these big corporations that make all this money, and now we have Negroes being paid $50 an hour to sit around on their butts in Detroit. However, in reality, we really have no more Detroit anyway, so it doesn't matter. Detroit moved to Mexico.
They're pushing for open borders, so now their union workers can compete against Mexicans.
Well, right. And at one time, unions were against illegal immigration and immigration from third world countries because unions had actually at one time had a little care for the people that they represented. At one time. It is, in fact, as a drama, as a spectacle, that M. Sorel looks upon the final cataclysm, or rather as a gigantic cockfight of such sanguinariness and of such dimensions that one can die happily after witnessing it. For what it is to happen afterwards, the lendemain de la revolution, one must take no thought. The anarchists, if we remember when we read about the 1848 revolution, the socialists in France came to power and they had no plan. Well, here she's saying the same thing about these anarchists who are trying to overthrow the state. They have no plan. They want to come to power and they have no plan.
Isn't that what I've always said? They plan to overthrow the existing order and replace it with nothing.
Well, right.
Because Satan can't create, can he? All he can do is tear down.
One must take no thought. It will be enough to have lived to see a tidal wave passing over the old civilization. It will thus be seen, not as a matter of surmise, but a fact, that the general strike is now advocated by the extremist leaders is simply the prelude to the great expropriation. By allying the latter plan with the workers' idea of a cooperative general strike, the syndicalists have now evolved the scheme of, quote-unquote, the day, which is to overthrow civilization. Of course, the workers themselves have no conception of the real design, and each time that a general strike is attempted, doubtless imagine it to be a brilliant inspiration on the part of their leaders in view of a sudden emergency. The miners are striking for a higher wage. Let us stand by them. Happy thought. All workers present a solid front to the oppression of capitalism. One, two, three, all together, strike. Thus playing on a simple camaraderie of the workers and urging them to solidarity in the interests of labor, the syndicalists hope to drive them onwards into the melee, which is to end in no amelioration of the workers' lot, but simply in the destruction of the existing social order. What is to avert the catastrophe? Just like Detroit, the UAW in Detroit did not create tens of thousands of well-paid permanent manufacturing jobs, did they?
They drove them out of Detroit, if anything.
Well, right. They drove them to Mexico. That's exactly what they did. What is to avert the catastrophe? Only greater knowledge on the part of labor. The first thing, then, is to dispel the illusion that the general strike is a modern and progressive measure. The workers should be told not only in its real purpose, but its history. They should be shown that, instead of being the outcome of any present emergency, it is an old scheme that has been going on for at least 50 years and has been turned down as impracticable by all intelligent groups of workers. Let us now follow the vicissitudes of the idea through the last half century. As a revolutionary method, Mermeau suggests that the idea of the general strike may be traced to the phrase of Mirabeau, "this people whose mere immobility would be formidable." Now, Mirabeau, as we know, was an Illuminatus. He then even the plan of the general strike as the weapon wherewith to deal the death blow to civilization entered into the gigantic conception of Weishaupt. In a vague sense, this is possible, but in its details, the general strike is, as Webster has shown, essentially a measure adapted to modern conditions. The plan was first definitely proposed at the Congress of the Internationale in Brussels in 1868, when the declaration was made that if production were arrested for a certain time, the social body could not exist, and that it was only necessary for producers to cease to produce in order to make the personal and despotic enterprises of government impossible.
And in keeping with this, what you've said before, that if we didn't buy into the Jewish system, if we just practiced Christianity, the Jews wouldn't be able to make a living, since they wouldn't be able to peddle porn, they wouldn't be able to peddle dope, pharmaceuticals, drugs, and they wouldn't be able to practice usury. If we had a general strike against them, we could run them basically into starvation, couldn't we?
Well, right. If all decent, moral, white Christians would just stop buying Jewish garbage, it would run the Jews out of the country. They'd have to leave. If we tear up our credit cards, tear up our magazine subscriptions, tear up the to things like Maxim, right to magazines like that, the Smut, People magazine, all the garbage, Reader's Digest, stop buying it, tear up our subscriptions to Blockbuster, our Blockbuster cards, tear up all the Jewish garbage in our life and stop giving them our money, they'd have to leave. That they wouldn't be able to function in our society. If we stopped giving money to phony charities like UNICEF and all these charities where the Jews basically make hundreds of millions of dollars and none of it ever reaches the intended or the claimed recipients, the Jews would have to leave. If we stopped buying all this garbage, the Jews would have to leave. They would just leave us alone. We would be able to return to a Christian society.
But the people aren't going to do that, since they want to feed at the trough, don't they?
Well, right, absolutely. They love their People magazine. They love their Reader's Digest. They love their National Enquirer. They love their ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, Fox News, whatever, you name it. They love their credit cards. They love to be able to buy something and not have to pay for it until 2020-something. They don't care if it costs them 10 times more. They want it now. And if they would stop all that, the Jews would have to leave. They wouldn't be able to make a living. They wouldn't be able to be parasites anymore. We wouldn't have a communist nation, and we'd be able to return to the nation that was founded here. But people aren't going to take change the easy way. That would be change the easy way, to return to our Christian principles. And repent, and Yahweh would heal our land. It's that simple. Stop buying the porn. Throw away your credit cards. It's that simple. But people won't do it. Stop buying cars on credit. Save up your money to buy things. That's a crazy thought, isn't it? Save up your money to buy something.
Or if the Jews honestly say that property is theft and no one can own anything and everything belongs to everyone, white people could just put that into practice. And if the Jews are selling goods, just take what you want. Since the Jew just got done saying that property is theft, the Jew doesn't own it, everyone owns it.
Well, right, but now we're living in a capitalist country, so property is okay because the Jew loans us everything we need at usury, and he ends up with all our property anyway.
Unless they want to eminent domain it, then they can take away the property that you already took out a mortgage to pay for.
Well, right, but they're going to end up with it anyway. There's no doubt when money comes into the economy with usury, that the people who have the ability to create that money are going to end up with all of that nation's goods and property. That's inevitable. That's what we don't understand. If you take the people in this forum, all right, and if we all live in the same little town, and you are the only one who's allowed to create money that we exchange, well, the first thing that's going to happen is you're going to want to import other people, because when you're creating money and you get paid interest for that money, you're going to want to have, first, more people to loan money to, and second, it's basically a Ponzi scheme that you always have more money coming back than you created, because each dollar created requires interest. So you need to grow that economy by at least that rate of interest in order to keep the Ponzi scheme afloat.
I always want more people in the scheme on the lower rungs of the ladder.
So first, you're going to load the town up with illegal immigrants, right? I mean, that's a given. But second, it's only natural that since you're making money for free and people have to produce goods to pay you back, and every dollar you make requires more than $1 to pay it back, that it's only a given law of economics that you end up owning everything in the community.
I think that was addressed in the riddle of the Jew's success, that when the Jew comes into town, he brings in more money than the town has, and he loans them money, and he's now artificially increased the amount of money in town, but they're not going to be able to pay him back because they didn't have enough money to begin with. So in the end, he owns the town.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. It's inevitable. There's no way around it. There's no way, if you're the only one in this little group that can create money and loan it out, and we have to pay you back more than we've borrowed from you, and we can't function unless we borrow money from you, then it's only inevitable that you end up owning everything. And that's what the Federal Reserve is. It's a scheme that the Jews set up so that they can own our country. And if you don't believe they own our country, you try doing something with our country that's contrary to their desires.
You get the JFK treatment.
In 1884, the government attempted to arrest warfare by founding the Bourses du Travail, or labor exchanges, which should not only provide work, but maintain harmony between employers and employed. But the Bourses, like the Chambres Syndicales, soon became hotbeds of revolutionary intrigue. And in 1888, the plan of the general strike was pressed with renewed vigor by the anarchist carpenter Tortelier. After achieving some success in the faubourgs of Paris, Tortelier the same year came to London, where he preached his gospel before a labor congress. But the apostle of the general strike, with his thick-set figure, bull's neck, hoarse voice, and slovenly attire, sounds like the average UAW representative, whose aspect suggested that of a satellite of Marat, was not taken seriously by British working men and met with scant success. In France, however, the cherished scheme of Tortelier found increasing favor. The idea of the general strike, says Marot, charms the working masses because it is so simple. And in France, there are always the anarchic elements who crave to faire sauter le bazaar. Thus, at a congress of members of the syndicates and of the bourses held at Nantes in 1894, the policy of the general strike was definitely adopted by 65 votes against 37. In the following year, the formidable association, known as the Confédération Générale du Travail, was founded by the extremists with the general strike as the principal plank in its platform. From this date, 1895 onwards, a 7 years war was waged between the CGT and the bourses, until in 1902 the bourses were finally extinguished and syndicalism was left in triumphant possession of the field. Several attempts have already been made to bring about the revolutionary general strike in Spain in 1874, in Belgium in 1902, in Sweden in 1909, in South Africa in 1911, and in France in 1920, but so far the firmness of governments and the resistance of the community at large have averted the climax of the grand soir dreamt of by the syndicalists, and their principal sufferers have been the strikers themselves.
It's interesting they mentioned South Africa. I remember seeing a black and white photo dated, I believe, either 1911 or 1921, sometime around then. It said, "Workers unite for a white South Africa, South African Communist Party." Isn't it interesting that they would make such an appeal, despite the fact that they knew in the end they were internationalists and they were going to betray white South Africa? But obviously they can't tell the white working class in South Africa, rally around this banner, and in the end we're going to give your daughters to Kaffirs. They can't say that.
Right, of course not. But this fact in no way deters the advocates of the general strike from pursuing their purpose, which has now become accepted policy of the CGT. At the same time, other revolutionary methods have been adopted with a view to fretting away the foundations of capital. Thus, after 1889, when the Dockers of Glasgow enforced their demands for higher pay by going slow, the policy of cockcanny became a definite part of the syndicalist program. In 1897, sabotage, which had hitherto been regarded as a measure of violence to be employed in the open warfare revolution, was introduced as a method of passive resistance. Railway men had discovered that with a pennyworth of a certain ingredient, engines could be put out of working, and the bright idea of applying this method to other instruments of labor met with an enthusiastic response at the Congress of Toulouse in 1897. Peugeot, one of its most ardent advocates, describes this incident as the baptism of sabotage. One variety of sabotage, known as obstructionism, introduced in 1905, consists in following out regulations to the letter, accomplishment of duty with excessive care and no less excessive slowness. Peugeot gleefully describes the inconvenience to which railway travelers may be put by this plan, for it should be remembered that the methods of syndicalism are directed not merely against government or employers, but against the whole community. It is therefore perfectly accurate to distinguish between syndicalism and socialism, because the policy of syndicalism is avowedly anti-social and oligarchic, while socialism at least professes concern for the welfare of the majority. The plan of the general strike further emphasized this division between the socialists and the syndicalists, for although, as we have seen, socialists are not unwilling to consider the idea of the parliamentary general strike, which will bring them into power, they have always continued to prefer the ballot box as a method of procedure.
Well, essentially, aren't the syndicalists
Bolshevik Russia
at war with the entire populace? They're basically saying, if you don't give us higher wages, we're going to let you starve to death. We're going to shut down the machinery of state, the machinery of industry, and not only that, but if you try and operate it, we're going to form lines, and if you try and cross the strike line, we're going to kill you.
Well, absolutely, but I believe that the syndicalism was just a device used to create anarchy and to put pressure on the industrialists and really put pressure on the workers themselves.
The workers would have you believe that they're only striking against management. Management mistreats us. We want higher wages. But what they're really doing is they're striking against society. They're basically saying, we want you to pay more for the product. So in essence, we're getting our higher wages through you paying more for the product.
Well, right. But as Nestor Webster explained here, the workers are really only being used by anarchists.
Mm-hmm. And they don't realize that.
No. As to the revolutionary general strike, this was opposed throughout, even by the followers of Marx, represented in France by the Guestists. I only wish someone would explain to me, says Jules Guest, how breaking street lamps, disemboweling soldiers, and burning down factories can constitute a means of transforming property. We ought to put an end to all this war of words calling itself revolutionary. No corporative action, however violent, partial strike or general strike, would be able to transform property. Thus, although the Marxians were at one with the syndicalists in wishing to bring about the grand catastrophe, they differed only in the manner by which it was to be effected. They, the syndicalists, said, the catastrophe will be caused by the general strike. It is the general strike that will be the catastrophe. This catastrophe is distinguished from that which is awaited by the Marxists, the socialist politicians, in that it will not be brought about by chance. It will arise when the workmen wish it. Syndicalism disciplines the catastrophe which socialists await with the fatalism of marabouts. But according to George S. Sorrell, the Marxians have entirely misinterpreted their master's meaning, which in reality excluded any hypothesis constructed on future utopias. In fact, Sorrell represents Marx to have actually declared that whoever has a program for the future is a reactionary. Now, of course, if Marx really said this, the whole theory of Marxian socialism is founded on a fallacy and is proved to be a system in which Marx himself never believed. But to do him justice, we must recognize that there is some truth in Sorrell's contention that Marx never pretended to have any devised definite system for the organization of the proletariat, that he merely made use of the enormous mass of ready-made material which he found in the British Museum for his great work on capital, and that it was his disciples who read into it ideas for the reconstruction of the social system. On these grounds, Sorrell is able to claim Marx as his ally, that is to say, as a pure destructionist. As the Jews love to brag about destroying everything, right?
Well, it's very interesting that they say planning for the future is reactionary, since the Seattle board, the public school board in Seattle, declared that planning for the future is racist, and I think they even used the term imperialistic. Here's what they said. The school defines racism as, quote, those aspects of society that overtly and covertly attribute values and normality to white people and whiteness and devalue, stereotype, and label people of color as other, different, less than, or render them invisible. Examples of these norms include defining white skin tones as nude or flesh-colored, having a future time orientation, emphasizing individualism as opposed to a more collectivist ideology, defining one form of English as standard and identifying only whites as great writers or composers. They said that if you identify individualism instead of collectivism, that you're a racist. Wouldn't they say that, though? They're all Bolsheviks.
Well, right. That's right. They're advanced Bolsheviks today. Nestor Webster's writing about rudimentary Bolsheviks, right?
I mean, 50 years ago, if anybody had written something like that, they'd be run out of town. Or they'd get a job at Columbia.
They'd probably get a job at Columbia. On these grounds, Sorrell was able to claim Marx as his ally, that is to say, as a pure destructionist, not as a syndicalist. For nowhere in Marx's writing could one find any hint of the syndicalist theory of industrial organization. But above it all is the great promoter of the class war that Sorrell finds in Marx his true affinity. To this one point, the apostle of syndicalism is ready to sacrifice all other considerations. The scission of the classes, he declares, is the basis of all socialism. The one thing to be avoided is social peace. Indeed, Sorrell's one fear is that modern nations, stupefied with humanitarianism, the phrase might be taken straight from Nietzsche, may prevent the conflict. To guard against this danger, every effort must be made to keep up the class war, not only by inciting labor to attack capital, but by stiffening the resistance of capital to the demands of labor. The more ardently capitalistic the bourgeois, the more the proletariat will be filled with a warlike spirit, confident in its revolutionary force, the more will the movement be assured, which demonstrates fully that none of the Bolsheviks really cared about the, I could lump the syndicalist and the socialist both under that category. None of them really cared about the working man. They only, in a paragraph, they only sought to use the working man to polarize society and to destroy it, just as they did here in America. It is necessary, therefore, by violence to force capitalism to occupy itself solely with its material role, so as to give back to it the warlike qualities it once possessed. Employers of labor must be made to understand that they have nothing to gain by works of social peace or by democracy. All then, Sorrell concludes hopefully, can be saved if by violence it, the proletariat, succeeds in consolidating class divisions and in restoring to it the bourgeois something of its energy. That is the great aim towards which it must be directed, the thought of all men who are not hypnotized by the events of the day, but think of the conditions on the morrow. Such, then, is the aim of syndicalism as set forth by its chief exponent, Georges Sorrell. At first sight, the one merit it seems to possess is frankness. Hitherto, revolutionary writers, to whichever faction they belonged, had always professed that their system would conduce in some degree to human happiness. Even the anarchists appeared to derive enjoyment from the prospect of their lunatic dreams of the future. But Sorrell promises nothing. Utopias of easy happiness, he openly derides. Even on the system of syndicalism, he has practically nothing to say. The only thing that matters is to keep up revolutionary ardor. Yet, after all, we find that Sorrell is not much more honest than his predecessors. For whilst denouncing the visionary socialists who lead the proletariat towards a mirage, Sorrell goes on to admit that the general strike, which, like Der Tag of the Germans, must ever be held before the eyes of the people, is in reality a myth. It will probably never come off, but just as the early Christians maintained their religious ardor by looking forward to the second advent, so the people must be taught to center all their hopes on the coming cataclysm. Doesn't that sound like these people today that are always talking about the next great disaster? First it was Y2K, now it's 2012. In between it was 2000. I think the book was.
What was it? Rahm Emanuel said, "Never let a good crisis go to waste."
Well, right, but they're always creating a crisis. False, as far as I'm concerned, the people that create pending crises are false religionists. That they have everybody afraid of what's going to happen next month, the month after that, the month after that. The date keeps getting pushed up, the month after that. And this is whose hands they're playing into.
Well, if you read Stormfront or follow Hal Turner, we should have invaded Iran in 2005, 2006. Martial law should have happened in 2007, 2008, 2009. It's always in the next 3 months. In the next 3 months, they're going to take the guns, get ready. It's the boy who cried wolf 10 times over.
Well, right. It keeps happening and happening. And that's what Well, why I try to tell people not to worry about what's going to happen tomorrow, not to worry about next week. Who cares what Obama's doing? Who cares what Rahm Emanuel wants? Who cares what Nancy Pelosi's doing? To hell with them.
Righteousness of the kingdom. Evil's going to do what evil does.
Thus, the idea of the general strike will serve the purpose of continually unsettling industry and fretting away the foundations of capital. To the normal mind, the theory of Sorel, as set forth in the foregoing pages, must of course appear unbelievable. The incredulous should therefore read his book for themselves in order to be convinced that such views can be seriously put forward. Is Sorel, however, sincere, or is he secretly an agent of reaction? The hypothesis is not beyond the bounds of possibility. At any rate, if the author of Reflections sur la Violence had been put up by the government to discredit the whole socialist movement by working it out to a reductio ad absurdum, he could not have stated his case more ably or have offended sounder arguments for the defense of the existing order against the encroachments of so-called social democracy. Experience shows, says Sorel, that in all countries where democracy can develop its nature freely, the most scandalous corruption is displayed without anyone considering it of use to conceal its rascalities. And after a scathing indictment of democratic government in America and elsewhere, he ends with the words, democracy is the land of plenty dreamt of by unscrupulous financiers. Well, America wasn't supposed to be a democracy, was it?
It's a constitutional republic.
Right, it's the Jews that reduced it to a democracy and the sheep that went along with the idea.
I recall Franklin said, a republic if they can keep it, and clearly we weren't able to keep it.
No, absolutely not. The republic ended in 1913.
You want me to take over for a bit?
Please.
But it is for the parliamentary socialists that Sorel reserves his bitterest scorn. The sole object of these people, intellectuals who have embraced the profession of thinking for the proletariat, is to bring themselves into power. In reasoning on social conflicts, they see in the combatants only instruments. The proletariat is their army, which they love with the love of a colonial administrator may feel for the bands which enable him to subject a great many Negroes to his caprices. They concern themselves with leading it on because they are in a hurry to win quickly the great battles which are to deliver up the state to them. They keep up the ardor of their men, as the ardor of the troops of mercenaries has always been kept up by exhortations to coming pillage, by appeals to hatred, and also by small favors which already permit them to distribute a few posts. But in reality, it will not be the proletariat who will share the spoils, for the prospect on which the leaders' eyes are fixed is the day when they will have the public treasurer at their disposal. They are dazzled by the immense reserve of riches which will be delivered then to pillage. What feastings, what cocottes, is that a French word she has there?
Yes, cocottes. And it's a delicate French dish, right?
I don't know much about French cuisine. What cocotte?
It's a sumptuous dinner.
Okay.
Let's put it that way.
What satisfactions to vanity? I think the old quote goes something along the lines of, those who wish to lead revolutions are not seeking to free you, they're seeking to become your new master. And we see that again here. Then at last, our official socialists can reasonably hope to achieve the goal of their dreams and sleep in gorgeous mansions. After that, it would be very naive to suppose that people profiting by demagogic dictatorship would easily give up their advantages. As to the dictatorship of the proletariat advocated by the socialists, but on which they do not much care to give explanations, Sorel declares that this would be a return to the old regime, a plan for feudalizing capital, and he quotes Bernstein in saying that it would end simply in the dictatorship of club orators and literators, who, he asks, is to profit by such government. Certainly not the country, which would be ruined. But what does the future of the country matter as long as the new regime provides a good time for a few professors who imagine they invented socialism and a few dreisafard financiers? In the opinion, therefore, of the great syndicalist, Jewish finance is largely interested in the triumph of state socialism. The inconsistency of Juarez and other French socialists on the question of Dreyfus is shown up in Sorel's book by a parallel drawn from the first French Revolution, of which he ruthlessly shatters the legends and destroys the prestige of the great revolutionary days. And he asks why Danton, of whom Juarez, in his great history of the revolution, had made a hero, but whose conduct during the sad days of September was not very worthy of admiration, should be defended on the score of acting in the interests of national defense when Juarez himself took part against the anti-Semites, who also believed they were acting in the interests of national defense in the matter of the affair Dreyfus. The revolutionaries were represented by Juarez as sacrificing immediate human tenderness and pity for the success of the cause. But then Sorel inquires, why have written so much on the inhumanity of the tormentors of Dreyfus? They too sacrificed immediate human tenderness to what seemed to be the salvation of the country. Not only Juarez and Clemenceau in France, but the socialists in England became in turn the butt of Sorel's pleasantries. Sidney Webb enjoys a very exaggerated reputation for competence. He had the merit of compiling uninteresting dossiers and the patience to compose one of the most indigestible compilations on the history of trade unionism, but he is one of the most born minds which could only dazzle men little accustomed to think. The people who introduced his glory into France did not understand a word of socialism, and if he is really, as his translator asserts, in the first rank of contemporary authors of economic history, the intellectual standards of these historians must be very low. And today they would just criticize you with swear words and expletives, wouldn't they? But at least he's doing it in articulate language. And Sorel adds that, in the opinion of Tardé, Sidney Webb was simply a blotter of paper. In order to appreciate the antagonism between the opposing camps of syndicalism and state socialism, it is only necessary to read Sorel's book in conjunction with Mr. Ramsay MacDonald's little work on syndicalism, where the fantastic program of revolution produced by the syndicalist is admirably shown up. And we've already shown they didn't produce any revolutionary program. They just took what was already there and built upon it. I mean, the Talmud already laid it out. There's nothing new. If the British advocate of socialism concludes the grand program of syndicalism is a mere delusion, its immediate action is mischievous. Sabotage, destruction of industrial capital, perpetual strikes injure the workers far more than any other class and rouse in society reactionary passions and prejudices which defeat the work of every agency making for the emancipation of labor. They put labor in the wrong. The syndicalist might be an agent provocateur of the capitalist, but he certainly is a tool, his tool. But in this feud between syndicalism and socialism, the mere continuation of the old conflict between anarchy and communism, it would be folly to see any security for society. The rival revolutionary camps may be and are bitterly antagonistic in their aims, but both will stand together for the overthrow of the existing social order. Didn't we come across this in Russia number one, that they were only seeking to overthrow the existing order for their own means and that no aid should be given to any parties that articulate opposition to the Bolsheviks because their ends are the exact same?
Well exactly.
So you can't support the Mensheviks against the Bolsheviks.
And it was sort of like different groups of parasites competing for the same corpse.
Well, there's only so much room on the dog, and the ticks are going to compete for that room, aren't they?
Absolutely.
The rival revolutionary camps may be and are bitterly antagonistic in their aims, but both will stand together for the overthrow of the existing social order, and only when the country has been reduced to chaos by revolution or to bankruptcy and ruin by socialist administration will the leaders of the opposing forces take each other by the throat in a life-and-death struggle.
And we saw that with the Jewish attempts on Bolshevik leaders, right?
You mean how Yuritsky in Zinoviev and how various other leaders were assassinated. One was assassinated by a Jew, and they called for the blood of the bourgeois.
Right.
Although, as we have seen in the preceding pages, the root idea of syndicalism, organization and control of industry by independent groups of workers, has somewhat been lost to sight by syndicalist writers who have concentrated their attention more on the revolution than on its morrow. A more constructive phase of the same theory has been inaugurated in recent years by the movement known as guild socialism. Now, guild socialism is nothing new. To anyone familiar with socialist literature, the task of embarking on the gospel of guild socialists, as set forth in the writings of Mr. G.D. H. Cole, must appear something like sitting down to read through a dictionary of famous quotations. But this is an experience to which the patient student of socialism must resign himself, for since by the middle of the last century, everything that could be said on the subject had been said already, and I would say it was said in the Talmud. Further exponents of the creed can only dish up the cold remains left by their predecessors. The process is, however, frequently very successful. Nothing is easier than to gain a reputation as a brilliant socialist writer by simply rearranging the same theories, the same phrases, and the same catchwords in a different manner to tempt the jaded palate. Yet never have the chefs of socialism produced a galantine to compare with that of Mr. G.D.H. Cole. Here, a little bit of Louis Blanc, there, a scrap from Vidal, but above all, solid slabs of Marx and Sorel, and all this concealed by a cunning glaze of modernity. In reality, guild socialism is simply syndicalism with the addition of a state, but the state is not to exercise authority, only to act as a municipal body, also as a banker to the workers, and occasionally as umpire in industrial disputes. So it's a de facto state. It's just not called a state. And the Jews are experts at that, aren't they? Euphemisms. The state would own the means of production as trustee for the community. And of course, someone has to run this trustee board, don't they? And I'm sure it's a Jew. The guilds would manage them, also as trustees for the community, and would pay to the state a single tax or rent. The assurance...
It sounds like Soviet Russia to me.
Well, didn't the Bolshevik leaders say that they were all guardians of the revolution on behalf of the proletariats?
Absolutely.
Stalin owns all the factories, but he's holding them in trust for the workers.
Right. And when it broke up, 10 Jews ended up with all the property.
The assurance of guild socialism. Well, I want to address that real quick. Some people think that Vladimir Putin's this great white patriot, and he's the great white hope who's going to restore constitutional governments all across Europe, or at least white nationalist governments, and he's going to sock it to the Jews and send them packing. The Jews put him in power. He's KGB. He was
well. The ten Jews that owned that ended up owning the wealth of Russia when the Soviet system broke up, they still own it, don't they?
Absolutely. He got rid of one because that one ran afoul of him in the state system, but that's one out of nine or one out of ten, and it was a show. The Jews still, I think the top 10 billionaires in Russia, they're all Jews. And you have to ask yourself, a man like Putin, as connected as he is, he must know that they're trafficking those young Russian girls all across the world. If he were actually a patriot, that would inflame his passions, and he'd be putting them up against the wall for it, wouldn't he?
Well, right. Most of the online sex industry would have come to a halt because they would have run out of blondes.
Right. A joint committee representing equally the state and the guild congress. Oh, I'm sorry. I've got to go back a sentence. But the state is not to exercise authority, only to act as a municipal body, also as a banker to the workers, and occasionally as umpire in industrial disputes. National finance would be decided by a joint committee representing equally the state and the guild congress. The state would own the means of production as trustee for the community. The guilds would manage them, also as trustees for the community, and would pay to the state a single tax or rent. And as you said, that's the quintessential Soviet system. The assurance of guild socialists, that the guilds would always honorably act to their part as trustees is based on confidence in man, although we note that a large portion of the human race, the present employing class, is to be regarded with the blackest suspicion. Apparently, the fact of becoming a guildsman miraculously does away with all such characteristics as greed and self-interest. All this is pure Bechez. What does she mean by Bechez? Is that a...
Duché. It's one of the socialist theorists.
All this is pure Bechez. And we have only to turn back to page 109 of this book to see guilds where every man is a master in operation, while Louis Blanc's Association of Working Men, financed by the state, demonstrate the precise system of guild socialism and, incidentally, its failure in the past. Now, when they say every man is a master, or what was it, Huey Long, which said every man a king, you can't have a society where every man is a king. Those are just empty promises. Unhappily, it is not in the spirit of Bache or even of the fanatic Louis Blanc that guild socialists set about their task. For all its professions of spirituality and love for humanity, guild socialism is avowedly revolutionary. To reactionary trade unionism, the guild idea looks, its aim is, the realization of industrial unionism, the building up of the whole body of labor into one fighting force. Borrowing Marx's phraseology on the doctrine of wage slavery, it sets out to promote class hatred of the most virulent description and advocates strikes to overthrow the capitalist system. In its denunciations of state socialism, the influence of Sorel is clearly detected. Now, are there any socialists out there that don't intend to build state socialism? They talk about a stateless society and a classless society, but of all the opportunities they've had to put that into action, have they ever done it?
No, because we've never had a classless society come out of socialism. And as soon as they get in power, they become the new bourgeois.
And I ask these people, these leftists, these Marxists, where is stateless society? Where is the classless society? Where is socialism? And they say that they just need to try again. And I say that you just want to give yourself a blank check to try again, and in the process maybe kill another 20 or 30 million white Christians because you're all Jews, and that really sets them off.
Well, that's the truth. It's Jews hiding behind isms.
They ought to just call it anti-Yahwehism or anti-whiteism. They hate God and they hate God's creation, and they want to kill as much of God's creation as they can.
Well, of course, but they sneak their way into our societies. They infiltrate their way into our academia, and they create these isms to hide behind and promote half of us to their side so that they could accomplish their ends. And then as soon as they accomplish their ends, they eliminate the people who are not them who join their side. I mean, we saw that over and over in Russia number one and in our discussion of the rise of Bolshevism in the Soviet Union.
Well, absolutely. What was it they wrote about Bakunin? They said that he was a great person for making the revolution, but would have to be shot the day after the revolution was over. So that tells me he was probably a genuine Russian.
Now, Boucher was a French historian, sociologist, and politician who also founded a newspaper and who also founded, he was one of the founding members of a secret society, the La Charbonnerie, which was modeled on the Italian Carbonari, with the object of launching an armed insurrection against the French government. And it failed, and he was tried, but he wasn't convicted. But he's just another social theorist and secret society member who died in 1865. And that's who Nesta Webster is referring to.
All right. The only point, then, in which guild socialism shows itself superior to syndicalism is that instead of concentrating solely on destruction in a general strike, it makes some plans for the morrow of the revolution. In its conception of guilds, of busy workers cooperating in a spirit of fraternity to make a success of their trade, it takes us back to the original idea of syndicalism, Proudhon's old simile of the hive, where we see, in imagination, the swarms of happy bees flitting through the summer sunshine, laden with honey for the comb, full of joy in their labors. This sounds like utopian Marxism out of Star Trek, where Captain Picard once said that there is no money, there is no currency, we work to better ourselves. Well, that just sounds like utopian Marxism served up on the TV for all Americans to watch. Isn't that essentially what it is? They said that people are just going to work out of the spirit of camaraderie and fraternity.
Well, right, but even Marx, as Nesta Webster explained, had no model for his ideal government to create that utopia. He just wanted class warfare. He was just an agitator who was just another vessel of the Rothschilds, I believe, creating a method of revolution.
He just wanted to put the worker at the boss's throat.
And who would fill the void when the bourgeois was when the European nobility and the bourgeois were eliminated?
The Jew.
And that's what we saw in Bolshevik Russia, right?
They killed all the landed nobility and replaced them with a Jewish bureaucracy.
And that's what we saw in the French Revolution also.
Yet all that is to be said in favor of the industrial system that guild socialism advocates can equally be said of cooperation. Cooperative industry exemplified by such schemes as profit sharing, co-partnership, etc., is simply guild socialism without its economic fallacies and also without revolution. This is precisely why cooperation finds in socialists and syndicalists alike its bitterest opponents. But there is also a further difference between cooperation and guild socialism. Cooperation is an honest movement, for it has always been willing to put its theories to the test by inaugurating industries on a cooperative basis. Sometimes these experiments have failed, sometimes they have triumphantly succeeded. Cooperation has not been proved a failure. But it will be noticed that neither syndicalists nor guild socialists ever propose to start industries on the lines they advocate, but always to expropriate, by violence, those already in existence and hand them over to the workers. In this respect, their record compares unfavorably with that of socialists. The earlier socialists, whose sincerity we cannot doubt, did attempt to carry out their schemes by means of communist settlements. Syndicalism ventures on no such experiments, although we could tell certainly that they were not sincere, were they, since Marx himself was living off the back of the English proletariat, and he was making money in the stock market.
Absolutely, he was a total hypocrite. That's just what I would expect of a Jew. I wouldn't expect any less.
And most people, they would call you a liar if you tried to explain, wouldn't they, that Marx was making money in the stock market and living off British textile workers via Engels.
He couldn't have believed a word he wrote in the end.
He was just writing. He's basically a modern TV evangelist who gets up there, gives a good spiel, and makes money off of idiots.
Well, right, but he was writing a means of revolution and actively attempting to upset society. But in the end, he wasn't writing any profession of his heart because he didn't practice what he wrote. That's what Christ constantly talked about in reference to the Pharisees, that to do what they say but don't do what they do. They would repeat the laws of Moses and of course their own injunctions on top of it, but they wouldn't practice them. They would go behind the scenes and rape and loot and pillage and use their position as a means of gain. Well, Karl Marx is no different than the rabbis and the Pharisees.
He was the 19th century Marxist Pharisee. And Marx wasn't even his name. Mordecai Moses Levi. This is the more significant in that the reason given by socialists for their failures in the past does not apply to syndicalism. For if one is tactless enough to question socialists on these abortive efforts, one is inevitably met with the stock reply, "Oh, of course socialism cannot exist in isolated communities. In order to test its efficacy, it must be adopted by the state." So their idea would be that it won't work on a small level. It has to be a national level.
Now they have it on a world level, but it's still not going to work.
And I would say if something doesn't look good on paper, you don't put it into practice. And if you put it into practice in a city and it doesn't work, you don't say, we just need to put it into practice in the state. Then when it fails in the state, say, we need it on the whole nation. We need it in the whole world. That's what evil does to spread.
Well, there was nothing wrong with the free enterprise system that we had, except that the Jew and the Negro can't prosper in it.
They weren't meant to, though. They can't make it on their own merits.
Well, of course not.
Now, although we know that it was not through outside opposition or competition, but from internal disintegration that these settlements went to pieces, it is nevertheless obvious that state socialism can only be practiced by a socialist state. This condition, however, is quite unnecessary to the existence of syndicalism, since the system it advocates is to consist of autonomous groups of workers independent of state control. But that's anathema to the Jews, isn't it? Autonomous groups of workers independent of state control. The Jews will never tolerate that. There is therefore no reason why these should not exist under the present regime. What is there to prevent a syndicate of miners from taking over a mine, or of factory workers buying a factory and running it on syndicalist lines? The huge funds of the trade unions would surely be better spent in an outlay of this kind than in strikes that deplete their exiter to no purpose. They're not interested in that, though, are they? They don't want to buy a factory and run it. They want to take over your factory and ruin it. For not only would a successful experiment on these lines satisfy the aspirations of all the workers who took part in it, but would proclaim to the world the efficacy of the syndicalist theory. Henceforth, only syndicalist industries would attract workers, and employers who continued to maintain the old system of wage payment would find themselves denuded of employees. Thus, without any violence, without the shedding of a drop of blood, the whole industrial system could be revolutionized. But they're not interested in an industrial revolution or a revolutionizing of the industrial process. They're interested in a bloody revolution in the streets for the sake of bloody revolution. Why is this not done? Simply because the leaders of syndicalism know that it could not succeed. They are well aware that an industry which adopted the principle of control by all the workers would come to grief as surely as a ship would that adopted the plan of navigation by all the crew. Well, I think we should go east, you think we should go west, he thinks we should go north, and in the end we go nowhere. In a word, they do not believe in the theories they teach. One experiment, founded to a certain extent on syndicalism, may however be quoted. This was the settlement inaugurated by William Lane in Paraguay at the end of the last century. Lane, an English journalist who had settled in Australia, appears to have been a perfectly honest man who had become deeply imbued with the doctrines both of Karl Marx and of syndicalism. Hence, he believed that the factory hand was the rightful owner of the factory, that the sheep shearer was entitled to the full profits of the shearing industry, that the legal owners of all forms of property were robbing the manual workers of their dues. Lane, therefore, entered wholeheartedly into the great syndicalist strikes, which at this date of 1890 were paralyzing the trade of the country. But perceiving the futility of this method of warfare, which had the effect of reducing the high wages of Australian workers to the level of 45 years earlier, Lane decided to found a workers' paradise in another land. Accordingly, at the end of 1892, he set sail with 250 faithful followers for Paraguay, where he started a colony under the name of the New Australia, a few miles from Asuncion, the capital.
Well, I'm sure they're all half Mexican now. The series of that are just spelled out in this Lane character, this is the essence of the religion of Robespierre, the economic beliefs of Robespierre, I could call it a religion, and of Marx, that the people that have the ability to create industry don't deserve the fruits of their creation. And we have sheep shearers because we have people who don't know how to organize sheep farms, right? So they get jobs shearing the sheep. We don't all have that ability to finance and organize a sheep farm. So we have to work as shearers. We have to shovel manure. Somebody has to do the menial tasks. And usually those are the people without the talent to have created their own jobs. That's just the way society is. We have to accept the inequality of man as part of the natural order. That you can be a real good garbage collector, but you can't be a doctor or you can't be an engineer.
And they say because that anyone can be anything. Well, no, not everyone can be everything.
Well, right, and that is the whole crux of the matter, that Marx and Robespierre would admit that anyone could be anything, and that is simply never going to be true.
And these people, to them, it must clearly be a religion, since they believe in it with a religious fervor. that sees them going from Australia to Paraguay.
Well, it is. It's the religion of humanism. It's the religion of evolution. No matter how you want to look at it, they're all different arms on the same octopus.
Well, here's from Henry Wickham Steed. I think he wrote this around 1910, 1920. Through 30 years, page 30. Moreover, to those who believed in Marx, socialism offered a substitute for religion. At a time when the old philosophies were losing their hold and the churches were reeling under the blows of scientific criticism, the Marxist doctrine, with its materialist conception of the universe, its economic syllogisms, and its promise of a better life to be attained through the socialist state, seemed to fill, with grounds for positive faith, a void of which many Germans had been vaguely conscious. It mattered little that these grounds for faith were not entirely new. They acquired convincing force from the uncompromising vehemence with which Marx stated half-truths as whole truths. Mere arguments rarely move the masses. Ideas that are put forward with all the qualifications requisite for approximate accuracy have little drive and cannot sway men's minds. Marx and his disciples propounded a set of dogmas, created emotions about them, and in reality founded a materialist economic church. These dogmas were drawn from a materialistic conception of the world and of history. Marx taught that the economic order is the basis of all social order, and that the legal and political structures of society, as well as religion and philosophy, are explicable only in the light of economic conditions. All social and political change, he contended, is the result of antecedent economic change. He left no place for the influence of generous ideas or for the ideas of justice or liberty. In the words which I afterwards heard his son-in-law, Paul Lefauger, use in public, Marx turned God out of history.
Well, right, and generosity to a Jew only comes in the form of...
you give your whole nation.
Either the Jew gives to promote himself or the Jew gives for a reason of tax deduction. So either way, to the Jew, a generous act is only an investment, right?
Marxism is basically an economic materialist church. It's a religion.
Yes, absolutely.
It's just another head of the beast. It's a limb of Satan.
Well, it's the yeah, you know, the Talmud, humanism is a religion of the Talmud. The Jew believes he's his own Messiah. And Marxism is basically its economic expression.
Well, it's just another name of blasphemy. And weren't we told that upon the beast are written many names of blasphemies? It's just another expression of evil in this world.
Absolutely.
Subsequent adventures of the settlers have been vividly described by Mr. Stuart Graham in a narrative which is much more amusing than Three Men in a Boat and has the additional merit of being true. It should be read by everyone interested in socialist adventures, for only a brief resume can be given here. At first, everything promised well. The colonists entered into possession of 350,000 acres of the very finest land in Paraguay, with pasturage sufficient to keep at least 70,000 head of cattle, and since all were filled with communal ardor, and also with the warmest confidence in their leader, there seemed no reason why a flourishing settlement should not result. But precisely the same experiences befell William Lane as had befallen Etienne Cabé 44 years earlier. The colonists, before long, took turns in quarreling amongst themselves and in accusing Lane of tyrannizing over them. Well, if these men could actually get things done, they wouldn't need to move to Paraguay. They could have succeeded in Australia, where land was cheap and plentiful, couldn't they? The cowboy, on the other hand, the man who worked arduously for 8 hours in the vegetable garden envied the more fortunate fellow who spent his day riding about the pastures herding cattle. The cowboy, on the other hand, considered that the schoolmaster had a considerably easier job, and he was perhaps moved to compare his lot with that of a colonist whose principal duty appeared to be to blow the dinner horn. Inevitably, bitter charges of favoritism were leveled at the head of Lane and at the heads of the foremen in charge of every industry. "We have surrendered all civil rights and become mere cogs in the wheel," wrote one of the colonists who had come to New Australia to find joy and work by all for all. "In fact, a man is practically a slave. Lane does the thinking and the colonists do the work. Result, barbarism." At the end of 14 months, Lane found himself obliged to expel a number of malcontents. In the following year, 1894, no less than one-third of the colony seceded of their own accord. "We came," said one, "to found Utopia, and we have succeeded in creating a hell upon earth." Well, the Jews already created that with their ideas. They just put the hellish ideas into practice, and look what happened. Seems all these people, they say that they're going to create a paradise on earth. Well, the only paradise is going to be when Jesus comes back.
Well, right.
And they won't accept that. They think they can make paradise. They think they can build the kingdom, and we're told to seek the kingdom, and everything else will be given unto us. Seek first the righteousness of the kingdom of God. "We came," said one, "to found Utopia," which means in the Greek, no place, doesn't it?
That would be Autopia.
Okay.
I'm not... Utopia is good place.
Okay.
It's a good place. It's a Autopus is a place, and EU would be the proper word to fit prefix to put in front of it, and that would mean good place.
Okay. "We came," said one, "to found Utopia, and we have succeeded in creating a hell upon earth." But on the arrival at this juncture of 190 newcomers who had been attracted to the new Australia by delusive reports, Lane was himself deposed and started off at the head of a few followers to found another settlement, which he named Cosme. For a few years, the two colonies struggled on in misery, but finally in 1899, Lane abandoned his experiment at Cosme and returned to Australia. And I'm sure he's probably the only one who has descendants that are still white. The rest are all probably mestizos today.
Well, no socialist experiment has ever succeeded. It doesn't work. Equal pay, equal reward for labor has never worked. If a man does not have the ability to keep the fruits of his inspiration and the labor of his hands, he's not going to care about his inspiration, and he's not going to labor with his hands.
By dint of employing native labor on the hated wage system they had set out to destroy, the Cosmians partly succeeded in restoring their shattered fortunes, but before long the socialist principle was recognized as a failure. And abandoned by both settlements in favor of individualism. From this moment, the energy of the colonists revived. In an incredibly short space of time, houses shot up, surrounded by well-tilled kitchen gardens. Very soon, the grasslands were once more dotted with cattle. In a word, New Australia became an average community of sane, sober, hard-working, self-respecting farmers, living at peace with one another and taking for their motto, "What we have, we hold." The experiment of New Australia offers an interesting demonstration of Proudhon's theory of the hive and the bees when carried out to its ultimate conclusion. For in New Australia, as in all other communal settlements, the principal difficulties encountered were the lack of public spirit and the inclination to slack. There is absolutely no regard for common property. One member of the colony wrote to the Pall Mall Gazette, "Moreover, it was freely alleged by almost every colonist against some other that the latter was working less vigorously for the benefit of all than he would have done in his own interest." Isn't that what they're always going to say? Everyone thinks everyone else is lazy.
Well, right. And the Christian principle is that you work hard, you keep the fruits of your labor, and you share them with whom you feel is worthy of them. And that's socialism and Christian socialism are two totally different things. Socialism, Marxian socialism, and all other forms that we've known outside of Christian socialism have meant that everybody works to the best of their ability and just takes an equal portion with everybody else, which is always going to lead to rivalry and accusation.
And
that's the American Union system. That's what happened to the American Union system, where every worker, no matter how hard or how little he works, makes the same salary simply because of his time and employment.
And if we're on a team project working to the best of our abilities and the best I can do is a 98% and the best someone else can do is a 62%, I shouldn't have to share a grade with them. I should get what my grade is. And I've been in those situations where the team has to share a grade. And if the best someone can do is not good enough, if the best someone can do is they can only feed themselves 3 days a week, well, they're only going to eat 3 days a week then. Unless they can find someone that takes pity on them and wants to make them the object of charity. Mr. Stewart.
Well, in the workplace or in the community, if people are can only reap so much for no matter how much they work, they're not going to work. That's the way it is.
Mr. Stuart Graham goes on to show us how this lack of energy would be overcome in a socialist state, and by a curious coincidence, he illustrates the fate of won't works under socialist administration by the same simile as Proudhon in a description of the massacre of the drones, quoted from Maeterlinck's La Vie de la Abbaye. I can't pronounce
it. The life of the Abbey, I think.
Oh, okay. The life in the Abbey?
It's the life of something, and La Abbaye.
The massacre of the drones.
Well, that might be the life of the drones. I'm trying to look it up.
All right, I'll start reading the excerpt. One morning, the long-expected word of command goes through the hive, and the peaceful workers turn into judges and executioners. Each one is assailed by three or four envoys of justice. Many will reach the door and escape into space, but towards evening, impelled by hunger and cold, they return in crowds to the entrance of the hive to beg for shelter. But there they encounter another pitiless guard. The next morning, before setting forth on their journey, the workers will clear the threshold, strewn with the corpses of the useless giants.
It's the life of the bee.
Mm.
It's a worker bee in Abbaye. So that's what it is. It's the life of the drunks.
The socialist administration is going to massacre the workers that won't work.
Well, right. That's the only answer, right?
Well,
That's the only answer, is you're driving people to slavery. You've enslaved the proletariat instead of having liberated them.
Well,
there's no salvation in socialism.
I suppose in theory you could feed them indefinitely at the expense of the workers, but as soon as I realized I'll get fed just the same as the guy down the street who stopped working a week ago, why am I going to work any longer if I can just become, you know, another dole on society? Get on the welfare roll and just start using food stamps. Of course. If I'll get nothing.
If every person was to get an equal reward from the produce of the nation, then why should anybody work? They'll all try to get over. That's only natural.
Well, I'll just feed at the communal trough, and then society will shut down. That's the ultimate. That's taking socialism to the ultimate conclusion, isn't it? If you can get something for nothing, why do anything?
Well, right.
On closer inspection, the industrial system of the hive is thus seen to be less peaceful than it had been represented by the father of syndicalism, Proudhon. Yet all the more it demonstrates the manner in which alone socialist or syndicalist administration can be carried out on a large scale. In isolated settlements of the kind, idlers or objectors can be banished. But once the system has been made universal, the refusal to do the share of work allotted to one can only be punishable by death. The text adopted by militant socialists as their battle cry, "If a man will not work, neither shall he eat," must be literally carried out by a socialist state and the proletarian disciples of Kakani, no less than the idle rich, as also those workers for whom no employment can be found, will find that the law of the hive can be even more ferocious than the hated government of capitalism. Isn't that right out of scripture? If you don't work, you don't eat.
Well, right, but it's taken in a whole different context, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Scripture didn't seek to make slaves of the man.
Certainly not.
The idea in Scripture is that you work to support yourself and help your community. You don't work to produce as much as possible for an equal share of pay with the rest of the community. It's not that this planned community of the socialists is an entirely different context.
Mr. Stuart Graham has well said that few, even among socialists, realize the ferocity of socialism. They imagine that the classic pattern of socialist administration, the Reign of Terror, was an accident that need not recur if the experiment of socialism is repeated. But we have only to examine the writings of socialists to recognize that the Reign of Terror was simply socialism carried out to its logical conclusion. Well, its logical conclusion would be the obliteration of everything in France that had a pulse. Isn't that what the socialists ultimately want, since they're all Jews?
Absolutely.
They want to destroy, tear down, wreck, obliterate. Thus we find even a socialist of such reputed moderation as Mr. H.M. Hindman writing these words: "The whole noble array of barristers, solicitors, accountants, surveyors, agents, and about 99/100 of the present distributors would be wholly useless in a properly organized society. They live upon the existing bourgeois system. They will disappear with the huckster arrangements on which they thrive. Since there is at present no way of making human beings disappear, it is obvious they must be killed off. For as Robespierre perceived, they cannot all be absorbed by work of essential utility, and can therefore only be left to die of starvation. So all socialist roads lead back to the old system of depopulation, and it is questionable whether the guillotine was not the humaner method. Syndicalism, at any rate, does not conceal its intentions in this matter. The massacre of the drones, and of those whom overcrowding of the hive forces to become drones, forms an essential part of the program that Mermet has well described as a neuronic dream. In the exultations of George Sorel over the coming death struggle between capital and labor, we seem to hear a Roman emperor rejoicing in anticipation over the collision between two racing chariots that is to strew the arena with the mangled remains of men and horses and drench its sand and blood. Syndicalism, as formulated by Sorel, is the plan of the world revolution, stripped of its illusory wrappings and revealed in all its naked deformity. It is avowedly anti-patriotic, anti-religious, anti-democratic. It is, in the words of one of its own advocates, Piaget, the negation of the system of majorities, and its sole aim is rule by force and violence. Far more than socialism, it is the direct continuation of the program of the Illuminati. Can we not see Weishaupt smiling in his grave as we read the words of Sorel? It is impossible not to see that a sort of irresistible wave will pass over the old civilization." So, being anti-patriotic, anti-religious, anti-democratic, in a word, Jewish.
Well, right. And we've come to the end of everything that Nestor Webster can offer us concerning insight into the Europe of the 19th century and the build-up to the First World War. And basically, we've seen, as she stated at the beginning of this chapter, which we covered 2 weeks ago, that most of these syndicalism, socialism, anarchy, most of these movements in France had been exported to France from Germany. And the Jews of Germany also attempted to export them to England. However, England had no interest in them. Probably, as I hypothesized, because the House of Rothschild didn't want to nurture an interest in these things in Britain. They already ran Britain. And I would like to... Well, basically, this is how we have the revolutions of Europe, and this is how we leave it. This is what we have: the socialist upheavals, we have syndicalism, and everything is aimed at destroying the fabric of European civilization. All of these labor movements, all of these philosophies are basically formulated by the Jews, the Jesuits, the secret societies to destroy Europe, Christian Europe as we know it. I would like to continue the series by moving on to see what's going on in Germany, right? Because we've concentrated so much on France with Nestor Webster. But Wilhelm Marr, the German journalist in the 1870s, foresaw the triumph of Judaism over Germanism in Germany. And I would like to cover that next.
All right. And if- If you'd like, I might be able to scan some pages from Henry Wickham Steeds through 30 years, but it's a two-volume set and it's pretty lengthy. There might be some excerpts out of there you might find interesting. He spent 30 years as a journalist and a traveler across Europe, and he spoke with a lot of Marxists. He studied at German universities in, I would say, probably 1880, 1890, 1900, around then, just as, you know, socialism and Marxism was really taking hold.
Okay, well, get it to me maybe by midweek, and we can consider that for next week instead. But they'll be our next places to go with this series.
Sure.
And it's all in an understanding of the social upheavals in Europe that paved the way for World War I and eventually Adolf Hitler in World War II, right?
With the normalization of social democracy in Europe, we should ask ourselves, are the European workers any better off today? Have they made any tangible gains?
Not one bit. They haven't gained anything.
They're paying 90% taxes. They have a social system that's being milked by immigrants from the third world. Their women are being raped on a daily basis. They can't use their own public transportation because they'll get stabbed by a gypsy with a switchblade. They have no rights. There are hate speech laws in place to protect the third world trash. They have no freedom. But they rally behind social democracy and look at the result. Clearly, the movement was never meant to liberate them from any perceived oppression, and I say perceived oppression because I dispute that it was genuine, actual oppression.
Well, as we've seen both with Marxist socialism and with syndicalism, which is one answer to Marxist socialism, it was the only alternative in 19th century France anyway. Basically, both systems are meant to enslave the workers even further.
I think we've more than adequately demonstrated that. It was a hypocritical, pharisaical lie from the get-go.
No doubt.
All right.
Oh, okay, I'll see you next week, and praise Yahweh, and God bless.
Thank you.